Now at Verizon, we're locking in low prices for 3 years guaranteed on my plan. And you can get a single line for just $45 a month when you switch and bring your phone. That's our best price ever on unlimited welcome with autopay plus taxes and fees guaranteed for 3 years. Because at Verizon, we got you. Visit your local Chicago Verizon store today. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Price guarantee applies to then current base monthly rate. Additional terms and conditions apply.
That's a gay ass podcast.
What? That's a gay ass podcast.
A what?
A really, really, really gay podcast that we call That's a Gay Ass Podcast.
That's a gay ass name for a gay ass podcast.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, the podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? It is me, Eric Williams, and how dare we go from one Tony winner to another? That's right, from Beth Level to this week's guest, Robert Horn, who is an amazing writer and turns out one of the funniest Jewesses I have ever met. Now, he is currently working on the new stage production of Hercules with Disney in London. He is also the book writer of Shucked, touring the country and about to open on the West End as well. He also worked with Bette Midler on her world tour. He was a writer-producer of Designing Women with Jean Smart. It's just like, she's it, y'all. She's it. And I have to tell you, this episode is an all-timer. And this is not hyperbole. This is one of my all-time fave interviews because he's so funny and just the advice is incredible. So if you are a creative type, if you're just a human being who feels emotions, or if you're dating someone who is different from you, just like we both date non-Jews from Georgia, you get it. You're going to enjoy this episode and I'm so glad you're here. So give it up for my girl, Robert Horn. Robert, two neurotic Jewesses are on one gay ass podcast. What will happen? Time will tell. How is your gay day going, Robert? Are you having a gay day or has it been pretty boring and straight?
I'm in gay old London, which is gay and old and London. And it is a gay day. I literally had two rehearsals today. So two musical theater rehearsals. If that isn't the quintessential gay day, I might as well just be on Fire Island.
I was going to say, rehearsal is one of the gayest words imaginable. In fact, you just told me off mic that you are an LA girly that went back to New York because you were originally from New York City. How does it feel to be, sure, in the gay town of London now, but living back in New York? Does it sort of make you feel like you're firing on all gay cylinders?
Well, you know, not when you have to wear 16 coats just to walk outside. I mean, what's the point of going to the gym? But I love New York. I'm from New York. And what really was, what happened is I started to work in sort of work my way out of television and back into theater. And I was just working in theater so much. It was so much back and forth that I just needed to move there. So I kept my house in LA. So we'll see what happens. My apartment doesn't have air conditioning. Let's see if I make it through the summer.
You know what? We're praying for you and we're
window units,
all
window units. I mean,
you're not hello. A New Yorker if you're not walking down the street and having a window unit drip into your open mouth
or sweating underneath your testicles, then you know you're a New Yorker because there's no humidity in LA.
Okay, wait. Here's the real test of New Yorkerness. When's the last time you cried in public in New York?
Oh, there's not a day that I don't. Are you kidding?
I think it's partly like a New Yorker thing. It's also like an erotic thing.
When they closed the Magnolia Bakery on my block, it was downhill from there.
Are you the type of neurotic Jewess that has like figured out a medication that lets you get through the day? Or are you just sort of raw dogging it and praying to our ancestresses?
Prozac.
Sure. I'm a Lexapro girl myself.
Are you? I'm Prozac. But I've only been on it for like 3 months. I just started. It's changed my life.
I'm so
sure,
happy.
Sure, you can't have an orgasm, but who, at this point, who needs them? I've had too many. Wasted so many children. You know what? I've been on Prozac for about 3 months now just to sort of like take the edge off. I was actually nervous about it because so much of what I do is about spontaneity and like harvesting that creativity in the moment and being sharp. Yes. And I was afraid it would dull that. Yes. And it doesn't at all. But I just like don't stress about stuff like I did,
Robert,
4 months ago.
I'm so fucking happy for you, because a lot of what we do on this podcast is talk about, sure, like our shame as gay people, but also just like the fucking horrible voices we have in our heads. And when I started Lexapro, it calmed some of it down, but it's still pretty active. So let me ask you about that as like your creative process. Thank God the Prozac is not dimming your light. However,
so far,
how do you, when you like sit down to write, do you have any like superstitions or traditions? Do you need to like smoke a J, put up Bette Midler cast recording? Like, what are we doing to get into our creative zhuzh?
Well, you know, honestly, I've been doing it a long time. So it's sort of a muscle that you just flex. It has to be quiet if I'm writing and I'm not in sort of in a writer's room or we're in production. I need quiet. I can't listen to anything else because I get so distracted, as they say in bestiality, once you go down that rabbit hole. Am I allowed to curse on this?
I don't think bestiality is a curse, but I do think that you might have some explaining to do with...
no, it's just a joke. You know, I love to work early in the morning. When I was in LA, I would get up at like 4, 4:30 in the morning. And because of the time difference, it was so... I just had this quiet time for like 4 or 5 hours. And I love to work early in the morning. And then anything else during the day just sort of becomes icing. I get more work done. I don't really have a lot of superstitions, but I make myself work every day. Often I'm on deadlines, but if not, I make myself work. Even if I throw it out, I just make myself work because I just have to keep sort of active in it. Or it's hard. The longer you don't, the harder it is to sort of pick it up again.
It was sort of like if you go to yoga every day for weeks and then you stop going for months, it's as if you haven't gone for decades. Like the rigor mortis, if you will.
Eric, I would not know.
Sweetie, I wouldn't either. I used to know. It's just I ask because I truly struggle with a lot of intrusive thoughts that tell me I don't even deserve to sit down to write. And I think that I'm learning in my gay creative journey here that the more I actually create things, no matter what, if it quote unquote fails or not, it of course is a win for me creatively and career wise. But I still struggle with like the thoughts that say you don't deserve to write, you are a piece of shit who has no talent, even though I know deep down that's not true. But like I look at someone like you who has such a long career, and it sounds like you've had this tradition of writing every day in the morning for a long time then, right?
I have, but I don't know if this is the gay in me or the Jew in me.
Tell me.
But I have that voice also. You always have that voice. And I pray and hope it doesn't go away. I think it's that voice that it's, you know, it's a really tough business. And writing is it's difficult. And you have to channel feelings and thoughts and that are hard, sometimes difficult. And in my case, you have to be funny when you don't feel funny, when you're depressed and it's that neurotic voice that tells you you're not good enough, you're not worth it, that I think gives you your unique voice as an artist and also keeps you going. And I honestly, when I went on the Prozac, one of the things that I asked him is it going to get rid of those demons that sort of haunt you every time you sit down and try to be creative? And my psychiatrist said it will quiet them, but it will never get rid of them. And I said, good. They're my friend. They're my enemy and my friends.
Right. Well, has it been your experience then that the voices are still there? They're just a little less loud.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. That has absolutely been my experience. But I also, it's funny because I took the tube home today with one of the actors from, I'm in rehearsal for two shows. And one of the shows, we had a really rough day the other day. Everybody just was sort of off their mark and starting to feel, really like, can I do this? And all their insecurities came out. And then the next day we had a great day. And I was talking to one of the actors and they sort of apologized for that. I said, I'm glad you all have that insecurity and that I can't do this. I'm not doing it right. And because it pushed you, the next day was fantastic. You just have to have patience.
It reminds me
Prozac.
Patience and Prozac is the name of something that I would love to collaborate with you on.
Two of my three favorite peas.
Is the third prosciutto?
Yes. Parking. Yes.
I just am very, very thrilled to hear from someone as established as you that you deal with the same intrusive thoughts that I do. And it's the thing that the gift that this podcast has given me is the awareness of great creators still deal with the same things. But the only difference is they get out of their own way and put shit out into the world. So because I do want to have more conversations about your writing, but I always love to get into the famous podcast question early on. So, Robert, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you, whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame, babe?
Well, I blame penis because...
There's the third P.
There it is. The thing about blame is it's as though something's wrong, and I love being gay, so I don't really find there's anything wrong with it. But I do have a memory of being very young and going to see The Sound of Music when it first came out in movie theaters and seeing Friedrich and realizing I was obsessed with him in a very different way than I was with Julie Andrews.
Sure.
And that was my first, like, oh, something moved down there. Then I ended up marrying a 6'2" blonde-haired Nordic guy, which I should have married a Jew. But I think that was like my first memory of, I don't ever remember a time that I wasn't gay. I didn't go through a big sort of transition with it or difficult time with it. From the minute I had any attraction to anybody, it was boys, and I was thrilled.
So when you saw Sound of Music and you were just like feeling the...
He wore those sandals and that started it all.
Sandals.
And the curtains. but I have a photograph, a picture that my mom took of me. I'm maybe 3 years old or 4 years old. On my sleeping on my Victrola record player and going around the was Judy Garland record with the rainbow, whatever it was Sony or Capitol Records, and it had like a rainbow around where you put the record on, and it's me sleeping on the record player and you see Judy Garland record. So I mean, you know,
Robert,
it's starting young. I'm dating myself, I guess, but no, I mean, I've always loved the divas. I've always been attracted to that. All those stereotypical things that you sort of say, you know, well, a gay guy loves it. That really was me. And I don't think it's ever gone away. Never gone away.
There's a reason why it is the stereotype, because it's true. And I think that the fact that there's a photograph of you at 3 years old sleeping on a Judy record makes me question, like, you know, did the gay universe choose you? Did you choose? It sounds like the energy of Judy Garland felt so calming to you. You could not help but slumber, and you felt safe in the arms of our mother Judy.
Our mother Judy, and also another soul with demons, and who just, I mean, here's another story. When I was very young, there was a Judy Garland movie called I forgot the name of it. I Could Go On Singing. Mm-hmm. And the movie is about her. She's a singer and she's just in this horrible relationship, and she just, the demons haunt her, and she's an alcoholic and all those things that we romanticize, I guess. And at the end of the movie, she comes out when they think she won't ever perform again. And she sings this song called I Could Go On Singing. I think I was 3 or 4 years old, and my mother took me to see the movie in Norwalk, Connecticut. And those days in movie theaters, there were curtains that would go up and down when the movie would start. And she was singing, I Could Go On Singing, and the curtain would come down, and I was screaming at the top of my lungs, "Don't go, Judy, I love you." And my mother said she was so embarrassed, but also knew that I was going to be gay.
I was like, Judy.
I love you, Judy, don't go. Yeah. And I'm like, really, like 4 years old. And the fact that my mother took me to that at such a young age.
I'm like so breathing that visual in, because you and I have a lot of similarities here. Not only are we neurotic Jews, but we also both married the shiksa from Georgia, because my husband is also a Georgia non-Jew.
That's where mine's from.
I know. I've done my research. And mine's from Atlanta as well. And
oh my
so,
God. What if they know each other?
Biblically, probably. New Testament. Why you gave a fleeting comment that you should have married a Jew. Can you speak more to that? Because I love to compare relationship notes.
Well, I mean, I shouldn't have married anybody but who I married, because I love him.
Exactly.
But there's something about, it's like being in the arts and marrying someone that's not in the arts. They will never truly understand the prism for which you view the world. And a non-Jew will never truly understand the neurosis, the beauty of the neurosis of being Jewish. And
the
legacy
sense.
And the history, I mean, our neurosis goes back generations. And especially if you married a shiksa goddess, as Jason would say, it's a very different. They don't show their feelings. They hold everything in and then they explode. And we're like, screw you, the hell with you, I love you, screw you, go to hell, I love you. I mean, it's all there.
100%.
And we also grew up around yelling and screaming and all that. And so it's just a very different cultural experience. But the truth is, I don't know if I could live with somebody that was just like me, because I don't know, but I'm very high maintenance when it comes to being neurotic. And so, and you know what? Here's the thing. And tell me if this is the same for your relationship. My husband, John, loves it. After a while, he's like, enough. But he's sort of, because he didn't grow up with that. He loves Jewish guys, and he just loves my craziness. And I need to be with someone that tolerates that.
My husband also, I make fun of him because I always say that his type is Jew. If like a somewhat Semitic man walks into a bar, I'm like, uh-oh. But like,
that's him. Jew and Italian. My husband loves it.
God bless.
But I got lucky because he picked me. There's a 10-year age difference between us. I'm 10 years older than he is.
Does he work in the industry, or he's completely outside?
He does,
outside?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
No, he does work in the industry. And he is obsessed with musical theater. And I don't think I could be with anybody that wasn't. He worked for Disney for many, many years. And actually, he's back there now working. He does creative content. And he's also – he's in the arts.
Well, I totally relate in so many ways. I mean, we are literally in couples therapy now, which I say with pride because I think everybody should be. Just talking about, the different perspectives, and I'm so obsessive about my work and my neuroses are so loud. And it's like, it's just trying to figure out how to really have a middle ground of respecting both of our views of the world. But you did mention the word Disney, so I have to bring up Hercules, which is
today?
Opening up in the West End soon. It's so fucking exciting.
It opens June 24th.
So June 24th, we're sitting here recording this towards the end of April. This is a movie that I say made me gay. And of course, when we ask the question, who do you blame? It is, who do we thank? And I thank the muses. I thank Lilias White. I thank LaShawn's.
It's amazing.
Unbelievable women. But my question is, now that you're working on this delicious new production, do you feel pressure to continue to convert other young gay boys to homosexuality like the movie did to me?
I don't feel to me, it's not pressure, it's privilege.
Oh, yeah. Another P word.
Our muses for this London production are so spectacular. We did our first table read the beginning of the week. And as soon as those first notes start, bum, 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 that Alan Menken score, and then, hold on, people, and, we are the muses.
Whoa, yes. Whoa, whoa.
And they start singing, and there's no roof left on the building. It is really gay heaven.
It's a gay fantasy.
It's anybody heaven. It's anybody heaven.
Well, true. I mean, it's like it's the Alan Menken, the orbit of Alan Menken is something that we need to touch in on, because his music is known everywhere. I mean, he is, one of the most award-winning creators. Question, though, if he worked on the original Hercules film and you're now coming in for this stage production, do you ever feel like the other woman since he was a part of the original? Or how has it been to, like, be a part of something that's so established?
I know how he kisses me. I don't know how he kisses her, so... No, I mean, you know, I never approach anything, even if it's source, if it's an IP, if it's source material that existed somehow, somewhere else. I don't saddle myself with that. I always approach it as though it's a new idea, it's a new project, and how are we going to do it? Because obviously an animated musical, and you can't do on stage what you can do with animation. So just the whole concept alone has to be different. It was 30 something years ago, so it had to be updated. And our incredible director, Casey Nicholaw, was very clear, as was Disney, about write your version. And I'm doing it with a gentleman named Kwame Kwayarma, who is heaven, delicious. He's my straight husband. He is obviously the artistic director of the Young Vic in London, a writer, a director in his own right for, you know, really successful. And he, we do very different things. And so Disney teamed us up to get, I was writing the show, and then, you know, the Hercules is black in the productions we've done. And once Black Lives Matter happened, I realized that I can't perpetrate a culture that I was not a part of. I can make it funny and I can work, but it needed to feel authentic to that experience, especially the mentorship of a younger and older black man and what that meant. And culturally, it's a very different thing. So they teamed me up with Kwame, and there's such, I feel, as a different than the movie, is there's a cultural depth to this version and thematically a story that goes so much deeper than the movie did. And I love that. And Alan and David Zippel, the lyricist, and our incredible director, Casey Nicholaw, and Ann Cord and Tom Schumacher and everybody up at Disney wanted that. They really pushed for that. To why does it have meaning now? Why is the story relevant now? What is heroism? What is it like to feel like you don't belong somewhere? And as a gay man, the theme of Hercules, which is where do I belong? I'm different than everybody. I don't fit in here. Oh, I think I fit in there, only to realize you fit in where you believe you fit in, and it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. And so that was the approach that I took initially, and that Kwame and I are taking to that. And so it's very different than the movie in that respect.
Well, that's really exciting, and I love that the depth that you're bringing to a show that is already so beloved. I think that's what's so beautiful about bringing something animated from so many years ago onto the stage, and especially with an A-list team that you've been working with. And I also think that it strikes me when you talk about, like, the gay experience of not feeling understood or feeling a part of something, and it's really beautiful to also see how then you have Kwame speaking to the Black experience of also feeling othered or feeling like you are not being seen as a human, but more judged by, you know, something at face value. So if we talk about the business of it all, since they are, Disney is such a giant machine, and of course a big Disney musical is something that makes a lot of gay guys like me thrilled. I mean, when I was following the Little Mermaid drama, are they going to put him on roller skates? How are they going to do the Under the Sea? So it's always like whenever you see, I hear about a new Disney Broadway show, I get very excited. So let's talk about then the business side of it. Hercules has obviously had a few previous productions. Casey Nicholaw has been working on it for quite a while. I know it was in Hamburg earlier this year.
Yeah, still in Hamburg, yeah.
Oh, it's still in Hamburg. So then is this London production? Of course, what are you hearing whispers about, like, a dream of a Broadway transfer? Or what can you even say about the actual, like, hopes for this production?
Honestly, I don't want to get in trouble for saying this, but Disney really waits and sees. They haven't talked about it at all. They have two big shows coming up now, Hercules and Greatest Showman. And I think Greatest Showman will open next year in London, I think, somewhere. Uh-huh. Hercules opens now. I think it'll all be about? How, what's the response to it? How does it sell? How, you know, there, Aladdin on Broadway still has a incredible life. So at what point will that leave and something else come in? So they haven't, I've heard nothing about any of it. And also I don't want to know. I just want to get this right. And then I let the universe do what it does. That's the Prozac. See, I would stress about that, but on the Prozac, I don't.
I say the word universe more than I would like to admit. And I think that it's like the thing I cling to in order to not, you know, jump off the ledge. But I think you're right that it's like, let the universe
jump
do
off
her
the ledge
thing
together.
Or let's just jump, girl.
Let's just jump.
But I do love the like staying in the present. We're going to slay this production. And then just like whatever happens will happen. And I'm also selfishly asking because when I'm sitting in a theater listening to the muses scream belt, I will feel gay euphoria. And I will also feel gay euphoria.
Just wait.
Oh, I can't fucking wait.
I can't imagine there won't be another production of this after this. I don't know, or how. Honestly, I don't know. But it's so thrilling. It's a thrilling production. And I can't imagine that Disney won't want the world to see it.
I can only imagine. I would have to agree. And I'm just going to zhuzh the universe to continue to do her thing. And
zhuzh
bring
it,
me,
baby.
Zhuzh it, yeah. Babe. I'm all-
Now at Verizon, we're locking in low prices for 3 years guaranteed on my plan. And you can get a single line for just $45 a month when you switch and bring your phone. That's our best price ever on unlimited welcome with autopay plus taxes and fees guaranteed for 3 years. Because at Verizon, we got you. Visit your local Chicago Verizon store today. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Price guarantee applies to then current base monthly rate. Additional terms and conditions apply.
Chicago, it's no mystery that Chevy is your best bet for the unpredictable spring ahead. The snow and ice may be gone, but the spring plot thickens at your local Chevy dealer, where you'll find the true MO of SUVs. If you're thinking about taking all the twists and turns in a new Chevy, you're not alone. The right vehicle makes all the difference when it comes to safety, confidence, and comfort on the road. You saw the Chevy lineup at the auto show. Now it's time to see which one you can identify. And don't worry, they can't see you behind the glass. Need the power and durability of a Silverado? The all-weather confidence of an Equinox or Blazer? The spacious comfort of a Traverse, Tahoe, or Suburban? Or the sporty city-friendly Trax? Your local Chevy dealer has exactly what you need to solve the case like a pro. So don't wait. Head to ChevyDriveChicago.com today. Browse the newest models, special offers, locate your nearest Chevy dealer, and start shopping online. Things are warming up out there, and you need a vehicle you can trust. Find yours now at ChevyDriveChicago.com. Chevy. Together, let's drive.
So judging the universe because I'm thanking the universe because I judged her previously to bring Shocked to Los Angeles where I currently live. And I have tickets to see Shocked when it's here soon. And I know that it is opening up in London May 10th with a delicious new production.
May 20th.
There.
May 10th is previous. We open May 20th.
So
yes.
May 20th, we open. Now, this is a show that I have a few connections to you two. One is Mike Bosner, who is the producer on it. I grew up with him, and he is...
Did you really? I'm going to tell him that.
So my first cousins are like some of his best friends. So just tell him Eric Williams or like a Jewish guy named Williams and the whole Williams family. He'll be like, I know who these people are. Producer Nathaniel and I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, doing shows at the Muni where Mike worked. So we have a lot of...
Mike is the best. Mike is a new generation of theater producers. When we opened Shucked in New York, he was the first. He was so smart. He was so ahead of the curve. First of all, when he's passionate about something, he's relentless. And he's the first. He had this idea when we were in rehearsal to bring in influencers into the rehearsal room to watch the process so they would start talking about the show. Nobody had ever done that before. In our previews, he made every ticket in the theater, I think like $69 or $65, so that anybody could afford to come and then spread the word about it.
Hell yeah.
And now everybody does both those things. And he was the first person to do it. And
well, it makes sense because I think it's such a very difficult landscape for an original musical. And so for him to create these new ways of getting the word out, it's so smart. I mean, you even have a quote where you say that he sort of like made it into the Corn musical and all of the Subway ads were like leaning into the campiness and leaning into the puns.
That's him. everybody was like, what is this musical? And he was like, let's not tell them. Let's just put stuff up to make them curious so they come and find out for themselves. And it worked.
People know that it's fucking funny. People know that it's hilarious. And then you get there and all of a sudden you're watching Alex Newell belt the shit out of that fucking song.
And Mickey Abrams does it on tour, and then we have this incredible Georgina, this girl who's doing it in London, who is she should be a muse. I mean, she is unbelievable. It's really exciting. But yes, Mike Bosner, what other connections?
Well, the other connection is that you have this quote that you say about the show is an overall message. The message comes from your private life. In this article, it says that when you, a certifiable semi-neurotic Jew, married a fella from small-town Georgia, both of the grooms sensed disaster ahead, dreading the response of their respective in-laws. You said, once we broke bread together, we learned to focus on things that we love and share and not focus on things that would divide us and become vitriolic. And what happened was we became family, and that's what our play is about. And obviously, that strikes me again as, you know, being this Jew married to a Georgia Catholic, and I'm very lucky with my parents and my in-laws because they are, you know, they know that while we are gay and live pretty different lives from them, they know that our love does not mean anything different than their love, but it's still,
Can I ask you, did they come to that realization through viewing your relationship? Because I know in my husband's case, both his parents, they were divorced, but they both struggled with his homosexuality, and he actually didn't talk to them for a while. And it was them seeing he and I together and the normalcy of it that really, and I give them credit for it, changed their ideologic point of, I mean, they're still Southern Baptists and they're always going to be Southern Baptists.
Right.
But their acceptance of it really transformed in just our happiness, mine and John's happiness together. And they were like, oh, well, I guess it's not really any different than the marriage I'm in. And that was an awakening for them.
It's incredible to hear, because I think that when you think about a Southern Baptist person, they are not taught to say, you know what, a gay love is love. I think that it's like they are literally told a lot of times in church, like, gays will burn in hell. When I first came out, my fucking straight brothers would make jokes or say things about, like they would joke about, like, crass things about sex, because I come from a very, you know, crass family, which is where I get a lot of my horny humor from. But they would make jokes about, like, a sex with woman, or a horny joke about a straight sex, and then cut to me making a blowjob joke, and all of a sudden it's disgusting. And so I had to be like,
tell me, explain that. Hypocrisy.
Yeah, you're talking about buttholes, and yet if my butthole belongs to a man that I'm munching on, that there's a problem. And so I think it's like, so I think that it was through, like, exposure therapy with, sure, not only just like the crass jokes, but about, like, my existence as a person dating someone I love dearly. I do think that them seeing us together sort of made it a reality of, like, oh, I'm not just thinking that gay, like, these gay jokes are gross. It's just pure ignorance. And so once you sort of, the ignorance is subsided by actual experience.
Well, whenever gender or sexuality or identity becomes political, it's dangerous territory. When it's politicized, it's never good, because none of those things are political. They're personal, and they are identity. And when politics gets involved, and pulpit gets involved, when religion, organized religion gets involved, it becomes a battleground, and it should never be a battleground. I mean, one of the reasons, truly, that is one of the reasons why I sat down and wrote Shut. It was during really Trump's first candidacy, and I saw how the things were being divided, and I saw them under my own roof, and how the people suddenly had permission to be homophobic and to be bigoted. And I wanted to write about it. And I wanted to I, you know, my philosophy is always if I can make people laugh, I can make them think. And it's so much easier to address things through humor than it is to, people just don't want to be clobbered over the head and told what to think. But if you could bring people from all different walks of life together under one roof in one temple of I call theater, you know, and get them all different people to experience the same thing and those same emotions and relate to those same characters, suddenly we have something in common. And so that really was both myself and Shane McAnally and Brady Clark, my collaborators on it, who are also both gay. That was our mission for the show, and it we took a lot of wrong turns to get it right, but it resonated with people, and it sort of took off because it is stupid, funny, corny humor, but it's also what people never expect with the show is by the end you're crying and you don't know where that came from.
Well, that's what I've heard, and that's what I love about your work too, and it's one of my. The way that I look up to you is that I love, and I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but the high low of it all. So it's like if you have like, you know, some corny humor, but wrapped around an actual deep message that has a surprising turn at the end, that to me is my favorite kind of art. It's like the idea that you can put posters in a subway about a corn musical, get all these different types of people into a theater, and then no matter what you hear from your audience, you know that they're walking away subconsciously with a message about acceptance. And that is one of the biggest gifts that audience members can have. But also as a creator, I think that's what makes the fucking horrible thoughts and neurotic things like
all worth really, it, right?
All worth it, which is, you know.
We wanted it to feel universal. You know, we wanted that sort of message. But I also, you know, it was really important to us to lead with laughter and to sort of know that we can all sort of laugh together about the same things. And the interesting thing is we never condescend because it's about a small Midwestern town and a sort of urban character that those two worlds clash. And we never condescend to any of it. The humor in the show is it's a little raunchy at times and it's really fun, but it's never mean. It's never cruel. And I think that's so important when you're writing something like that I don't love mean humor. I love catty humor, but I don't love mean humor just to try to get a laugh. And so that was really, really important to us.
So it's basically like you're not making fun of the setting. You're not making fun of a Midwestern
point
of view.
Right. In fact, the opposite. We're sort of celebrating both. We do make fun of both Midwestern and urban, and we celebrate both. And at the end, they come together. I won't give anything away, but the story, it's about a small town, fictional sort of Brigadoon-esque fictional town that grows corn as their livelihood. It's their commerce. It's everything. Everything is about corn. And they have their own way of life, and they don't want anybody to come in and tell them how to live their lives. And so they've built corn on every border of the town so that they've closed themselves from the outside world and no one has ever left or come to this place. And when the corn starts to die, it threatens their way of life because if it opens them up to the outside world, then somebody could come in and tell them they're wrong and somebody could come in and tell them they're not living the way they're supposed to. And so that's what it's about. And then chaos and craziness ensues and somebody goes out to get help and brings it back. And at the end of the show, the corn comes back to life because one of the characters says the corn grew that day because the town did, because they've learned to love someone who is different than them. And that actually is why the corn died, because the corn died because they closed themselves off from loving other people. So there's this really beautiful message in it. It's just couched with a lot of comedy.
I'm going to tell you that it really resonates with me because I just started to work on this new solo show that speaks to a very similar thing.
I love that.
I'm bringing it to New York, actually. I'm about to set the date for this summer. So to all the gorgeous gay ass listeners, I'll see you in New York. But
go see Eric Williams.
Thank you so much, Robert Horn. But a big part of the story is that I constantly felt like the freak of my family and the freak of where I grew up because I am 6'2". I have a twin brother who is 5'4".
Wait, you're Jewish and 6'2"?
Thank you for asking. And the answer
that
is
an anomaly. I mean, come on. I'm 5'6".
Well, my entire family is around 5'6". My twin brother's 5'4". My mother's 4'11".
I'm a twin also.
Robert.
Yes.
Look at us, this crossover.
I know.
It's cool. You know, and my twin is a straight guy who has grown up to be the sweetest. Like, it's to see him parent has been so great. But the truth of the matter is he was my bully growing up. He was like a total piece of shit to me as a kid. And so a lot of what I grew up was feeling like the corn was dying around me, if you will, because I was so feeling misunderstood and told that my gut feelings were wrong. You know, people are making fun of you for being gay, Eric, but you're not gay. At least we hope not, was the message I was told. And so now it's like to see how I've been able to embrace myself as my own person has brought my family closer to me because they're seeing, you know, if I'm treating myself this way and not accepting that treatment of being told I'm different or less than, it has, quote unquote, made the corn grow back in my life. And it's like a painful lesson to learn. But I think that it's comedy or otherwise, a show like Shucked is, I think it's really important that we continue to put those messages out, which is like, don't treat people less than you if you don't understand them.
And also, comedy is always grounded based in drama. Comedy is drama through the prism of humor. That's all it is. And if the actual situation and stakes are not dramatic, there's nothing to really hang the comedy on. So any comedy is really relatable on a dramatic level. You're just laughing. But I knew as a writer, I knew I was going to be in the arts and I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I knew that on one hand, I didn't want to be known as a gay writer. I wanted to be known as a writer. On the other hand, that I wanted my gayness and my experience in life to influence what I was writing. And I got really lucky because at the start of my career, I got to write Designing Women and Living Single and High Society. I mean, I wrote the gayest shows that you could, and was asked to bring who I was to it. And so as I learned my craft, I did it by celebrating who I was. And not everybody gets to have that experience. I got very lucky in that respect. You know, I wrote Bette Midler's, you know, worked with Bette Midler on her world tour. I mean, I have gotten to work with like these icons of gay culture. And it's thrilling. It's thrilling.
Well, I was researching.
I'm still a little kid pinching myself all the time. I really am.
And thank God the Prozac didn't take that away from you too, because I think the Designing Women of it all, Jean Smart's big break was really that show. And now to see her, I mean, I just literally watched the most recent episode of Hacks last night. And
so
I marvel at her. I marvel at her ability to, like we're talking about actually, be so fucking funny and biting, but have such a deep sense of humanity underneath it all. And
she's a spectacular artist. She really is.
Well, and then
I
you also did,
her.
You did High Society with Jean Smart, which is.
Yeah, I did. Well, I created that for her after Designing Women. I was like, I've got to work with you again. I've got to do this. And I created High Society for her to star in.
Well, so this is a question because you've worked on Designing Women, you worked on High Society, you've done also, as a gay millennial, I have to bring up the Disney Channel original movies. You did Teen Beach Movie, of course, Beach 2, The Squeakquel, Sharpay's Fabulous Adventure, The Suite Life Movie. But you've worked on such a broad range of, like, you know, we're talking about Disney's Hercules, big IP. You've done this Bette Midler giant tour. But let's talk about, like, if a show like High Society gets canceled or you get a no from the universe or the world, how are you building yourself back up for someone like us who hears thoughts that say we're less than? And then if you do get that no, how do you keep it trucking along? Or do you allow yourself to grieve for a limited amount of time? How do you pick yourself up?
This business is, you get more rejection than anything. And I mean, 90% of your experience in this industry is rejection. Truly is. But for me, there are two things. One, I can't do anything else. Honestly, this is what I do. And I was very willing to spend my life sacrificing anything of value for that. If it meant I was just going to be broke ass poor my whole life and whatever it was, I was willing to do it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is I had to learn how to, when I got a rejection, I allowed myself 3 days to say, I'm quitting. I'm never doing this again. I'm done with this fucking business. I hate it. And then what do I want to write? You know, Hal Prince, whenever a show opened, he made sure the next day he was starting a new show. So you did not have time to worry or think about the reviews or what happened. You started. And so that's what I do. I give myself a couple of days to just be really depressed. And then I start something new. And that always, and I go, I'm back in it. And you know, you can't write something in the hope it's going to succeed. You write something in the hope that it ends up what you want it to be. And if it succeeds, it succeeds. Most of the time, it doesn't. The more successful you get, the more opportunities you sort of get. But I get rejected all the time. I still compete for jobs and don't get them. You know, so it's an interesting.
Have you announced to yourself or to anybody that you're quitting the business in recent years?
Oh my God. In recent weeks. Are you kidding? Yes. Yes. All the time.
I'm like, stops.
I can't do this. I can't do this. This is, you know, yeah. I just was up for something that I wanted really badly. I won't say what it was. And it came down to me and one other person and I didn't get it. And I was like, you know, what do I got to do? I mean, how else do I have to prove myself? What else do I have to do?
Well, I'm asking the same fucking thing. For you on
and
your
you know
behalf.
What? I thank you. But it's okay because something else popped up that I probably wouldn't have been able to do had I done that.
And
so,
there you go.
So, but you know, so much of this business is creating your own work, is generating your own work. And, you know, success is just this serendipitous meeting of opportunity and ability. You got to hope that you get the opportunity and you got to be ready for it when it comes. And you have to know who you – that's the beauty of being gay and being an artist is that even though you're fighting an uphill battle in a lot of ways, as a gay man, I know my identity and it's different than other people's identity. And as a writer, you have to have your own identity. What is your point of view? What are you trying to say as a writer and how are you saying it? And that's what gives you a voice. And so when you look at anybody from David Sedaris to Neil Simon, you know, this, or to Mel Brooks, to so many, you know, so many great writers, not gay writers, but great writers, they know who they are. They know their voice, their comedic voice. And as a gay man, I think that celebrating that has helped me define who I am as a writer, because whether I'm writing about a gay experience or not, that my worldview comes into it.
And it makes so much sense. That's why I think I was so in awe of David Sedaris as I was growing up, is because I could feel his energy come off of the page and I felt like I was with him. And the biggest gift that I'm trying to give myself is to at least allow my voice to develop by putting shit out there and not censoring my own art.
You can't worry what other people – I get this question from people all the time. And people will make – often artists will make every excuse they can make to not do their art.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes to writing, people say, well, I don't know format. I don't know how to structure this. I'm like, who cares? Eventually, the writer's assistant will do that for you. You know, somebody that you'll then pass on your knowledge to. Just write. Just do it. It doesn't have to be, pardon the pun, but it doesn't have to be right. It just has to be, you just have to have a passion for it. It just has to be. And it's okay if you throw it away.
100%.
But don't you find that you just have to do it? Like
100%.
When you get an idea, you just, yeah.
Well, that's the funny thing is, if we full circle to our relationships, I think what I've had to learn is that I am obsessive and I need to talk about it and I need to, it's like, it's always all hours of the day. And so finding boundaries of like, of course, he is nothing but supportive and so like a huge theater queen and goes to all
the arts.
He's not. We first met auditioning for Fiddler on the Roof at 54th Street and 8th Avenue in New York City almost 12 years ago. But since then,
wait, was that the Fiddler that Rosie was in?
Oh, sweetie, this was a regional production that paid $4 a week.
Wow, that was pretty high. For regional.
Yeah, it was a dinner theater in Wisconsin and we both did not book, but we have that shared dialogue or that shared passion. But I also am such an obsessive creator that it's, you know, it's hard to like leave him alone.
But I love, you're lucky because you, I can't perform. I have no talent in that area, but to be able to be a performer and a creator so you can actually create stuff for yourself is a really great thing.
Thank you for saying that. That's actually, I think you were sent by the universe to tell me that, because I think sometimes I come from a scarcity mindset of just like, you know, you don't have the success you want and it's never going to happen and boop, boop, boop. But I do feel like because of this podcast and all the other things and talking to people like you, it's all going in a beautiful direction. And Robert, you are such an inspiration to me. But before I butter your biscuit fully, I want to ask you the final podcast question, which is, if the world was ending, you could only save one character actress, who would you save?
I think a lot of your audience won't know who this is, but I would say it's probably my favorite actress ever. It's Rosalind Russell.
Teach the kids, Rob.
Go download His Girl Friday, download The Women, download The Trouble with Angels. Rosalind Russell, who was, by the way, very, very religious and bawdy. She's a brilliant character, leading lady and character actress, but a brilliant comedian. And whenever I'm doing a show like Shucked, I tell, because the pace of, it's very vaudeville and very 1930s in its pace. And I say, watch Rosalind Russell movies and you'll understand what I'm looking for in terms of, yeah, so that's who it would be. That or Thelma Ritter, but probably Rosalind Russell.
Well, I'm looking at Rosalind now and she's absolutely gorgeous. And and to see, she's a Connecticut girly. She died in Beverly Hills in 1976. And she has, okay, she's done Auntie Mame, Gypsy, The Women.
Rent the movie, gays. If you haven't seen Auntie Mame, if you've not seen, not the musical Mame, the movie Auntie Mame, shame on you. Download it. It is a rite of passage for anybody who's gay. It truly is, because it's also about, well, you know what it's about, but it's also about being different and being flamboyant and following your own music. You know, and she's brilliant in it. It's a glorious movie, and actually it was one of my coming out movies. Like that was for me. That was one of my. I mean, that's one of my Desert Island movies.
You woke up from your slumber on the Judy Garland record. You sat down on the couch and ended on Roz. Yeah, and then you ended on. I mean, it's such a great answer. We have our gay ass homework for all the girlies listening, and let me just tell you that I think when I saw Tootsie on Broadway, I thought it was one of the best books I ever heard on in a Broadway show. And to see your continued success tells me that the universe is doing her thing, because you deserve the most, because you've given us so much. And I'm so grateful you came on this gay ass podcast, Rob. I really, really am.
Oh, you're really good at this. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled for you and your success and your growing success. And also that you're celebrating us as gays and as Jews and as artists, there's so much division going on now, and we're being attacked again. I mean, this is one of the things I'm saying. It's like, children, get out in the streets. That's what we had to do. You can walk down the street, or could until the last year or so, holding hands and getting married because we lay down in the streets and the generation before me did. And it's time again to do that. And the way to do that is by lifting each other up. This is a time of solidarity, not division. And don't look at other queens and roll your eyes, and don't look. That is your brethren. That is your girls. Those are your girls. And celebrate them. And you're celebrating that. And I love that.
Well, that is so well said, and I completely obviously agree that we gotta band together and stay as gay-ass girlies. Now, Rob, will you tell the listeners, again, the dates for Hercules and Shocked in London, and also where they can follow you to connect in any way you would like?
I do Instagram mostly, and it's at rhorn1, R-H-O-R-N-1. Shucked will open at the Regent Park Outdoor Theatre in London on March 20th. And Hercules will open at the Drury Lane, the Royal Drury Lane Theatre in the West End on June 24th.
I cannot wait to
and
see.
And Shucked will be in L.A. And let me know, because I'll make sure that you go back and say hello and meet the cast and say hello
Thank
to everybody.
You.
Oh, and I'm actually going to be there. I'll actually be in – I'm going to go for the opening in L.A.
Oh, amazing.
The tour is doing so incredible. You know, it's an interesting thing. America, the country, is just celebrating the message of the show. And we're playing massive houses. And it's selling out and doing really well. It's just – people want to laugh, and it's time for a message like this.
I cannot wait to see it.
The cast is spectacular.
Oh yeah, I've been following the clips and all the genius social media stuff, and yeah. So mazel tov on everything, Rob, and I'll see you in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Isn't Robert the Fooking best? I'm telling you. One of the greats. And if you enjoyed this interview, please click subscribe on YouTube or the Apple, Spotify podcast platforms. And if you're on YouTube, drop us a little comment to let me know what you thought of Robert or who you would like to also see on That's a Gay Ass Podcast. Bonus episodes are at my Substack, so just go to Substack and search for Eric Wills. You'll see bonus horny episodes every single week and full-length confession hole episodes. That is my glory hole talk show. I'll see you all next week for another gorgeous gay ass guest, and if you could just do me the biggest favor, stay gay. Bye!
You've been listening to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, hosted by me, Eric Williams. If you want to see and hear more, make sure you're subscribed to us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, or Patreon at Gay Ass Podcast. That's a Gay Ass Podcast is executive produced by Eric Williams and produced by Nathaniel McClure. We'll see you next week.
Now at Verizon, we're locking in low prices for 3 years guaranteed on my plan. And you can get a single line for just $45 a month when you switch and bring your phone. That's our best price ever on unlimited welcome with autopay plus taxes and fees guaranteed for 3 years. Because at Verizon, we got you. Visit your local Chicago Verizon store today. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Price guarantee applies to then current base monthly rate. Additional terms and conditions apply.